If you're going to use data to tailor marketing efforts or the customer experience, you have to be able to create value for a consumer when you use that information.
Hello, and welcome to the Banking and Payment Show, a Behind the Numbers podcast from eMarketer and sponsored by Wells Fargo. Today is November 22nd. I'm Rob Rubin, GM of Financial Services here at Insider Intelligence and your host. This is our sixth episode of this new series, How Time Flies. If you enjoy this podcast, please give us a five-star rating and subscribe. In today's episode, we'll first look at some headlines that impact customers' trust in their banks in our segment, The Headlines. In our Story by Numbers segment, we teased out some examples from our recent benchmark study that demonstrate the impact of engendering strong trust. And the title of today's show, Which Big Bank Has the Most Digital Trust, foreshadows what we're going to cover in our third segment today, which we're calling The Rankings, where we'll discuss where incumbent banks and neobanks rank in our digital trust benchmark this year and why. In our last episode, Ahan Sarkar, GM of Helix by Q2, and I discussed the trials and tribulations of neobank lenders in a rising rate environment. I've invited Tiffany Montes, principal analyst at Insider Intelligence, back to the Banking and Payment Show to talk about a topic that's really elemental in financial services, trust. More specifically, digital trust. Hi, Tiffany. How are you today?
Hi, Rob. It's great to be able to connect with you again.
I'm excited to have you here. But before we start, I have a quick riddle for you. Why shouldn't you trust Adams?
I don't know.
Because they make up everything.
That is definitely one of the better ones that I've heard from you.
Thank you.
It's a winner. A winner for sure.
I know. I had a whole long list of them that I was choosing.
Fortunate enough to hear them.
I was testing them with my family. They're sick of me. But there you go. I laid it out and it worked. So you know that trust is one of those attributes that is incredibly hard to earn, but also incredibly easy to lose. Certainly, Tiffany, everybody who's listening to this podcast knows that trust is essential for a bank or anyone that's going to hold your money. But to me, the topic feels a bit amorphous. You know, the qualities that engender your trust might not be the same qualities that I think are important. So before we start, I just want to ask this question and have you lay it out. How do we at Insider Intelligence measure consumers' digital trust of banks?
That's a great question. You know, I think one of the things I'd say before we get started is you're right. I think that trust is really hard to gauge because consumers all have different needs. And I would even layer on top of that, that consumers are fickle. They might like you today and that sentiment may change tomorrow. But before we jump in, why don't we start with defining what trust is? Mm-hmm. And so if you think about trust, really defining something that is qualitative as trust isn't easy. But for the purposes of the benchmark, we define it as the confidence that consumers place in their bank's digital channels, so mobile and online.
So we're not talking about, do you trust the bank in a big, giant way? We're specifically asking about mobile and online.
Exactly. And we break down trust really into six measurable pillars, we'll call them. So we have security, which is how well financial institutions keep customers' information safe. The second is privacy. So whether or not that financial institution does or doesn't share customer data in a way that makes them feel uncomfortable.
Okay.
Reputation. Are they known to be an ethical organization? Reliability in the digital channels, feature breadth. So does it cover all the features that consumers need? And then ease of use being the last one. So how intuitive is it for a customer to use digital channels to be able to navigate and complete transactions or even self-service capabilities?
And what we've done is we've developed a survey, right? So did we survey consumers about these features or these pillars?
Yeah, so each of the pillars and then features within each of the pillars to gauge what their interest is or what is important to them around those six areas of digital trust.
Okay, just for listeners to know that when we surveyed these consumers, we specifically asked them who their banking institutions were so that we were asking them these questions relative to their banking institution, right?
That is exactly right.
So if we talk about PNC Bank, which we're going to talk about, the survey results are from their customers. The survey results for Bank of America are from Bank of America customers.
Correct.
Great. So thank you for that, Tiffany. It was very good and important for us to establish as we launch into this podcast. And let's get started with the headlines. Our first headline, spike in destructive attacks, ransomware boosts bank cybersecurity spending in 2022. This is a story that we published a little while ago about banks doubling down on their security budgets to protect against a spike in destructive attacks, ransomware, and island hopping, which I didn't know what that was, but it's a term describing the process of undermining a company's cyber defenses by going after its vulnerable partner network rather than launching a direct attack. So it feels like attacks are kind of inevitable. So let's say that a bank experiences an attack that compromises customer data. Are there steps that banks can take to limit customer attrition? Because when they do get an attack, they're at risk of losing their customers. And could they even use it to capitalize on how they're handling it to engender more trust?
Yeah, so I think the most important thing that institutions need to focus on when events like this occur is really communicating what happened and what steps they took to correct the issue and what they've done to make sure that it doesn't happen again. And when we talk about not happening again, you know, I think one of the things that we could say is I don't know that you can ever promise that a cybersecurity attack isn't going to happen again, but at least let them know that you've addressed the issue and what you're doing going forward. Outside of all of that, I think the most important thing that financial institutions can communicate to customers is to let them know how it impacts them, what they are going to do for them to make the situation right, and how they can protect themselves. And when I think about all of those things, I think the most important thing that they should take away from that is that in all of those activities that you're doing to communicate, to make them whole, to let them know that you've done everything that you can to rectify the situation is that you do all of that flawlessly.
Right. And that's where it falls apart, right? Like you can make the plan, but it's in the execution of it. And have we seen examples of that where they haven't done it flawlessly?
I think there's been some examples in the past. I think probably everyone remembers the Experian issue with the breach that occurred there. And they did come out, maybe not communicated as quickly as they should have. But some of the communications and even some of the way that they were letting customers know whether they were or weren't impacted, some of that fell through on the execution side and just created a much bigger issue for them than they already had to begin with.
Yeah, they compounded it. The thing about promoting your cybersecurity efforts, so you want to get out there and say, I don't know if I'm aging myself when I use the reference Fort Knox. Do you know what I mean by Fort Knox?
I do.
It's like super secure, right? So we are the cyber version of Fort Knox. Nobody can penetrate. If you come out with that message, doesn't it look kind of bad if you say you're airtight and then you're successfully attacked? It sort of suggests that there's a bit of nuance in how you might promote your cybersecurity efforts. What do you think best practices might be?
Yeah, I mean, I think there definitely is a nuance there, right? I guess maybe it's better described as an ongoing risk. And the ongoing risk is, if you think about hackers, they continue to get more sophisticated. Their skill set, we'll call it, continues to grow. And as it grows and they get more sophisticated, you're not going to ever eliminate all of your risk. It really is about managing it from two different dimensions. Like, how do you educate your customers on how they protect themselves? And then how do you invest in protecting not only their data, but your enterprise?
Yeah. And I think that over time, more and more people are getting used to the idea that they have to protect themselves. Certainly in our company, and I know every bank, the employees have to take trainings on security and to be aware of different threats. So I think there is certainly more awareness. But at the same time, it just means that you get a more clever criminal.
Yeah, from a consumer's perspective, they really want to know how their information is being used and shared with third parties. And so the more that you can communicate that up front and allow consumers to be able to control what they would like shared and what they would not like shared, the better position you're going to be in terms of not only maintaining their privacy, but knowing that they can trust you to adhere to whatever their preferences are.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Our second article is titled, Wells Fargo Launches Virtual Assistant, Cleverly Named Fargo. This was a recent story in Forbes. Wells Fargo is launching this new virtual assistant, Fargo, and it competes with Erica, who is Bank of America's virtual assistant. And Chase hasn't named its virtual assistant. I'm going to suggest Morgan.
I love it.
But my question is, How can Fargo, which is a conversational template using AI, help the bank engender trust?
You know, I think I'll broaden this comment for everyone, because I think what I'd say to Wells Fargo is very similar to what I'd say to any organization, which is conversational assistants or virtual assistants or chatbots or however you prefer to refer to it really helps financial institutions be able to reinforce the features that they offer in mobile banking. And so really the opportunity is, if you're thinking about trust and you're thinking about privacy and you're even thinking about reputation, how can you, in the interactions that you have through Fargo, in this example, show that you support the community, how you're helping your customers, and how you're helping more customers as it relates to financial wellness? So how do you, in real time, serve up financial insights that allow consumers to be able to meet their short and their long-term financial goals?
I think that's a really great observation for how they can leverage it. But I think that there's maybe also the flip side, which is if their current version of their AI bot, their chat bot, is not reactive enough or responsive to what the end user is asking, that might have the opposite of engendering trust. Like, they don't understand what I need. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think it's about finding the sweet spot of the handoff, right? So right. If you're noticing that the right answer isn't being given, at what point do you hand off to an actual person who can answer that question more directly and take it to more of a one-on-one chat conversation versus using AI?
Right.
And I think for every institution, sort of that threshold of when you do that handoff is different. And I think it probably is a lot more handoffs in the beginning. And as you start to optimize and even be able to support more use cases in the bot, then over time, the amount of handoffs that you do should shrink.
Great. And just real quick for fun, what would happen if Erica and Fargo conversed with each other?
Well, I think they would fall in love. They would start a family and they would name their baby Farica.
Nice. A little baby bots.
Little baby bots.
Nice. Let's kick off our second segment, Story by Numbers. And in this segment, we've selected two numbers that highlight the value of proactively building strong digital trust. I'm going to read out the number and why and ask you a few questions to get your insights. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Great. It's really two numbers. It's 79% versus 58%. 79% of customers with high trust in their bank are satisfied versus only 58% of customers with low trust are satisfied with their bank. And it seems strange that anyone who doesn't trust their bank would continue to keep their money at the bank, but we pointed out that we're speaking about trust in their online and mobile channels for one, but also that it's a spectrum, right? It's not, I don't trust you, therefore I'm gone. It's that you maybe don't trust parts of you, or there's a little doubt, but it doesn't mean that you're going to move your relationship. So I think that it's funny that a bank can erode your trust and keep your money. But today, it's quite complicated for U.S. consumers to switch their everyday bank because of all the digital tentacles like ACH payments, direct deposits, online bill pays. And so being completely dissatisfied with your bank doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to switch, because you might not have the time to switch, or you might be scared to switch because it means that you're going to miss a payment and it's going to cause a problem, or you don't have enough money to cover the payment in both places in case there's a lag between switching. So it is hard for people to switch banks, and that's always been a problem. So my first question is, because we were both at Money 2020, but I missed it. Didn't the CFPB announce something at Money 2020 regarding making it easier to switch banks?
Yeah, so the CFPB said that they were moving forward with regulation that would accelerate the shift to open banking and to open finance. And the director, Rohit Chopra, said in prepared remarks to an audience in Money 2020.
Right.
The rule that they proposed will empower people to break up with their banks that provide bad service and to unleash more market competition. So suggesting that through open banking and open finance, that it will be easier for consumers to switch from one financial institution to another, or even to establish new relationships with potentially alternative providers.
The sticky parts for consumers are really about being able to switch bill pay. So theoretically, with open banking, they should be able to migrate their bill payees from one bank to another. The more complicated one will be the ACHs, which are really controlled by their billers, not the banks.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
So that's going to be like a hairball to try to unwind that one. That'll be a little hard, but we'll see where it goes.
I think lots of people have tried to solve the switching problem, and I will say we're still kind of where we are, right?
Yes. Do you agree that having strong digital trust is going to be even more important when it's easier for consumers to switch banks?
Absolutely. We know that online and mobile banking today are really one of the top reasons that consumers switch banks. And as customers continue to engage with digital channels over physical channels, digital will be the battleground for trust. In other words, as financial institutions feature breadth, make digital features more reliable and easier to use, they will also need to reinforce how they protect a consumer's privacy, keep their accounts and information secure, and also in a digital environment to be able to build and rebuild their reputation. So all of those interactions that could have some influence by offline interactions, you know, that percentage of interactions will shrink and digital will grow. And it will make it the next battleground in terms of keeping or building trust.
I always have believed that overall, as it relates to customer service, if it's easy to switch banks, there's going to be a bit of a reckoning in terms of customer service, that banks are going to have to be nicer because it's going to be easier to leave. But at the same time, there might be unique value propositions that appeal to certain consumers who wouldn't otherwise jump because it was hard to switch, that they might jump. There might be quite a bit more attrition than we see today, which is traditionally like 8-9% a year.
Yeah. And if you think about it under the context of like feature breadth, for example, and you think about customer service. So like if you build a really great feature set that drives down the volume to your contact center, and you can do that in a way that is quick, seamless, easy, and there's resolution at the end of whatever someone's trying to do all in a digital environment, then you're not going to have the issues with like, we'll call it traditional customer service where you have to pick up the phone.
Right.
That starts to be taken out of the equation.
That would be great because it's expensive and it rarely makes people happy.
Very true.
For our second number is 70%. And it's according to a survey by Tinuiti, 70% of consumers would rather receive less relevant ads than have their behavior tracked. And for marketers who've been striving for a right time, right product, right place to always be able to do it, the idea that you have an addressable audience that you can reach with insight that would make them act is so appealing. So what can a bank do to respect their customers' privacy and serve up relevant product recommendations?
You know, I guess the first thing I'd say is, according to Merkle, 70% of consumers expect to receive something in response for giving a brand their data. So what that tells me is that if you're going to use data to tailor marketing efforts or the customer experience, you have to be able to create value for a consumer when you use that information. So they're definitely willing to share their information. They just want to know that you're doing something that will benefit them in return for that.
So like a message, oh, we can improve your current rate because we know what your rate is. So you will save X dollars or make X dollars more. That kind of thing adds value. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, getting really to that deep personalization that I think we have yet to see in the industry. So using your example of credit card, if you're going to offer someone a credit card, you already know that they have one. You need to be able to tell them in quantifiable terms why this credit card is better for them than the credit card they had before. And if you can get to a point where you say, as you just mentioned, you can save X amount of money, or based on your spending over the last year, if your spending remains the same, this is how many reward points that you would earn. That is something that is quantifiable. And from a consumer's perspective, very tangible. And I can see the value as to why you made that recommendation to me versus just sending me something in the mail saying that I am pre-approved for a card.
Just something different around that is the geolocating, which is throwing someone an offer because you know they're physically in a place. So in that example, if you know someone's in Best Buy because they're on their mobile app, you're tracking them and you've seen that they've walked into a Best Buy, can you send them a text with an offer so that they can finance a purchase of over $500 with some special incentive? Is that creepy, or is that something that consumers find valuable?
You know, I think I'll go back to one of the comments you made at the beginning of our conversation, and that was everybody has different needs and very different desires and probably even different levels of creepiness where they feel. And so some consumers may find value in that, especially if it's attached to a 0% APR, and especially in the kind of rate environment that we're in now. But other people might believe that it's overstepping. Again, I think it's about how attractive you make that offer.
Right.
I might think it's creepy if you're only giving me $50. Somebody else might think $50 is great. We all have different needs and motivations. And I think it's probably an important thing to keep in mind when you talk about using data.
Right. That's a really good observation. And, you know, I might think, how do they know I'm in Best Buy? Right.
Start looking around, circling yourself.
Yeah, that's weird. I didn't know I was that important. Before we go to our third segment, the rankings, let's hear from our sponsor, Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo is a leading financial service company that proudly serves 1 in 3 U.S. households and more than 10% of small businesses in the U.S. Wells Fargo is proud to provide a diversified set of banking, investment, and mortgage products and services. For the communities we serve, the company focuses on building a sustainable, inclusive future for all by supporting housing affordability, small business growth, financial health, and a low-carbon economy. News, insights, and perspectives from Wells Fargo can be found on stories.wf.com. And now, back to the show with our third segment, The Rankings. In this segment, we're going to talk about the top 3 digital trust categories based on our survey of mobile banking customers in August. And we're going to look at how the different banks have done. And for fun, I'm going to be picking out a bank name whose ranking in the category surprises me. Tiffany, you can tell me why they fell as they did, how they can improve, or stay in the pole position. But before I put you on the spot, let me put you on the spot and ask you to summarize why, and I'm going to announce this, why Capital One ranked number 1 in our 2022 banking digital trust benchmark.
Okay, so while you're putting me on the spot, but not putting me on the spot. So Capital One secured the highest score again this year for the 2nd year in a row, placing in the top 3 across all 6 categories of digital trust. So they landed at 86.1 points, which is out of the maximum of 100, and they far surpassed the study's average score of 83.5 points. When we start thinking about the 6 categories in the study, they took first place in top valued categories, security, privacy, reputation, and reliability.
Well, those are all really important. So I was going to jump to security, which is the first category that I'm going to ask about. And in our benchmark, it represented 24% of all points allocated. So you could get a maximum of 24 out of 100 points in that category. My question to you, Tiffany, is that PNC surprised me here because they ranked towards the bottom of the list and they seem to take a pretty decent drop from last year. So my question is, what happened?
So if we think about 2021, PNC ranked number 2, but they dropped to number 11 in this year's study. Mm-hmm. In 2021, the digital banking trust benchmark, we highlighted PNC's Bank's Security and Privacy Center because it provided easy access to plain language descriptions on its security and privacy policies. Mm-hmm. But in 2022, PNC still provides easy access to information. But what changed was there isn't necessarily any singular event that we can point to. Our benchmark scores really help our clients be able to develop communications and content marketing strategies. And in this case, PNC has an opportunity to review their plans to make sure that they're building in enough messaging on how the bank protects consumers' information across all the different channels. And again, since this benchmark is focused on digital, and when we meet about across channels, really their focus should be on mobile and online.
So really, when you think about it, when they're building their communication strategies, if they were to use those pillars, security, privacy, reputation, et cetera, and then they thought about what they're pushing out, either tweeting on different channels, they could almost grade those communications against those pillars to see if they're hitting those points, to make sure that they're not ignoring a point. So in PNC's case, maybe they have to beef up their communications on how they protect security so that consumers start to see that when they think of PNC, their customers think, yeah, I feel pretty good about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's probably even more important for new features, right, where consumers have not had an opportunity to use them and may not have experience using them elsewhere is really to promote security and, to your point, privacy.
Privacy is our second pillar. Based on overall consumer responses, privacy was the second most important areas where banks can really build or lose trust. So what surprised me when I looked at the results, because this year we did something a little different. We mixed in the neobanks and the incumbent banks together to see how they compared. And what surprised me was that Chime and Current ranked second and third for privacy over incumbents like TD and Chase. So why do their customers feel their personal information is so safe?
I think it's really interesting that customers gave them such high scores for privacy. It's likely due to the fact that banks haven't really done anything to make them feel annoyed or nervous, like constantly selling to them or selling their information.
So they don't have any products to sell, and that's why they like them, because they're not trying to sell, they're not cross-selling to them. You already have our product.
Congratulations, you have our product. And I mean, I think anything else that they advertise, again, if we go back to the statements that we talked about earlier around exchanging data for value, their consumers may feel as though they are getting value out of the communications that they do get.
What do you think incumbent banks can learn from them?
I think what they can learn from them is probably making sure that you're communicating things in simple terms. And as we talked about earlier, making sure that when you do use data, that you're doing it in a way that creates value for the consumer, that they can clearly see that they get something out of exchanging information about themselves that will put them in a better financial position.
You know, when I went back and I looked at PNC's Privacy and Security Center, and I feel like they did a really good job making legalese easy to read and accessible. Chime, they do a really good job with their FAQs and answering the questions, and then they put the legal stuff sort of towards the back. So they still keep it, and I'm sure PNC has it too. I just never found it. But I think it's interesting how they really focus on the accessibility of the language and how they describe how they share their data, who they partner with, and things like that.
Yeah, when you think about disclosures or just talking about financial products in general, I think the industry has done a great job of teaching consumers banking jargon. And then you've got banking jargon and you layer that on top of legal language and things start to get really blurry quickly. And where they have done a great job, to your point, is just really creating disclosures and answering questions in simple language. But for those people that want to see the actual legal terms and all the other disclaimers, putting them in a place to go deeper in those areas if they choose.
Exactly. And then our final number that we're going to talk about in this segment is reputation. And out of six categories, reputation was the third most important factor for digital trust, according to the August survey. It garnered 15% of total points allocated. And reputation is a quality that is unfortunately, or fortunately, especially easy to lose. So my point is proven with Wells Fargo. They've been doing a lot to try to win back their reputation. What do they need to do differently?
You know, I think for them, it's really about continuing to do more of the same. It will take a while to rebuild their reputation. And if I start to just think about what advice I'd give really to anyone, because to your point, trust is, and even reputation is, hard to build and easy to lose. And so really, my advice to all banks would be to make sure that you're following through on your commitments to your customers, communicating when and how you'll follow up with those commitments. And honestly, when you screw up, own your mistakes. Be transparent and honest about what happened and how it happened. And don't forget the little things like reinforcing security, privacy, and reputation in all your digital interactions. And when I say digital interactions, it's not just about the features that you have in mobile banking. You also need to be able to do that in your marketing efforts as you start to acquire new consumers as well. And building trust really starts at day one.
I really love what you said there, reinforcing security, privacy, and reputation in all digital interactions. And I really think that's critical to engender digital trust. I want to thank you, Tiffany, for today. That's all the time that we have. I want to thank everyone for listening to the Banking and Payments Show, an eMarketer podcast. Also, thank you to our editor, Todd, and our sponsor, Wells Fargo. In today's episode, Tiffany and I referenced data from the U.S. 2022 Digital Trust Benchmark. Clients can go online to review right away, and future clients, please visit insiderintelligence.com for more information. Our next episode is on December the 6th, and you'll not want to miss it. See you then.
Bye.